We're supposed to be done at 5:30, and they've given me 40 minutes to talk. We've got barbecue and beer waiting across town, so I'm not going to be the one to hold you up. So I'm going to fly through this pretty quickly so that we can get out of here as close on time as we possibly can. The title of my presentation may give you the impression I'm just going to stand up here and go through a laundry list of things that I think that you have to be doing in order to prepare yourself to deal with these animal welfare issues that we're currently facing or that we will continue to face in the future. But honestly, I think it would be a little disingenuous of me to think that I have all those answers, okay, especially since I don't know what your situation is in particular. So instead, what I'm going to do is just talk about a couple of different topics. The first thing I'm going to talk about is kind of throw out some thoughts as to why animal welfare issues have just seemed to explode onto the stage here within the last few years. I'm also going to talk a little bit about what consumer opinion is of farm animal welfare, particularly and related to the beef cattle industry. And then I'm just going to finish up throwing out some thoughts or some ideas of what's going on in the livestock industry currently. And then I also want to kind of peer into a crystal ball and predict for you where we're all going with this in the future regarding these animal welfare issues here in the U.S. My hope is, as I go through this, that you will start framing up in your own mind how you need to position yourself or your operation, whatever the case may be, to deal with these issues. Because as that title says, this time around, these issues are here to stay. We've seen these things come up in the past and fade away, but I think this is just going to be standard operating procedure for the livestock industry anymore, is dealing with these types of animal welfare issues. So with that being said, let's start out and talk a little bit why all of a sudden here within the last couple of years it seems like these issues have just, come at us at a firestorm. In order to do this, I'm going to use a presentation that I saw a while back at a USDA-sponsored event. And this presentation was given by Wes Jamison, who is a professor of communications at Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida. And the reason why I like to use Dr. Jamison's presentation is he kind of packages it in a way that I've never seen before. And I find it quite unique, and as I have kind of thought about this whole animal welfare issue over the last couple of years as I've been looking at it in great detail, I've kind of drawn some of the same conclusions he has, but he's done a more articulate job of expressing it than what I've been able to. So, start out, Dr. Jamison begins by defining what a meta-narrative is. A grand story. If you want a Webster Dictionary definition of this, this means, it's a term from the social sciences, which is an abstract idea that is thought to give a comprehensive explanation of historical experience or knowledge. So now that I've defined it for you, and now that you've had the time to read the slide, you're probably still sitting there wondering, what the heck is he talking about? What's a meta-narrative, right? Well, fortunately, Dr. Jamison does a good job of explaining that to us by using an example that I think that we all can relate to. And that is, why do we as Americans think of America the way that we do? Meaning for the most part, excluding maybe some in Washington, D.C., whose names I won't mention at this point in time, but for the most part, we Americans think America is an exceptional place. Okay, why do we think that way? Well, a meta-narrative attempts to explain that by saying that it's because of all these stories that have been told about the American experience, and all those stories wrapped up into one makes us think about America the way that we do. And I think this little picture right here at the top of this family standing there, obviously immigrants looking at the Statue of Liberty, says a lot. But if you think about our forefathers fled freedom to come here to the U.S. to find, or fled persecution to find freedom here in the U.S., and they braved incredible hardships. They talk about all the wars that were fought in our history to preserve freedom around the world. On and on and on those stories go. And so in the end, when you wrap it all up into one descriptive term, it would be, American exceptionalism. Okay, so that's the meta-narrative. So using this same thought process, he goes on to try to describe how we have thought about animals in America in the past. Okay, and essentially that meta-narrative translates into a big fancy term here called anthropocentric instrumentalism. With anthropocentric meaning we as human beings have typically thought that we are the most significant entities in the universe. Probably most of that thought process comes from our religious background. In Genesis, God gave man dominion over the animals. And instrumentalism kind of comes from the idea that the value of an object, including animals in this case, lies within its usefulness. Okay, so we as human beings in the past, and we still do at this day and time, value animals on their ability to improve our well-being, essentially. So we value the horse on its ability to plow ground so we can plant seed, put food on our table and money in our pocket, and the same with the dairy cow, and essentially the same thing with the dogs. And so that has somewhat translated into what our old welfare, or kind of what welfare is to us in this room. And that is, we can use animals as long as we minimize pain and unnecessary suffering. And the reason why we try to minimize pain and unnecessary suffering is because it harms the value of the animal, which in translation would be harmful to us. So our old animal welfare laws here in America reflect this, as well do, you know, our animal welfare standards at this day and time. But as Bob Dylan once so eloquently said, the times are a-changing. And as we realize, we are now being questioned as to why we are caring for or handling animals in the livestock industry at this day and time, where these types of issues weren't even discussed 10, 15 years ago. Well, I think you all probably know this, and the reason why this has happened is because for a significant majority of Americans, the role of animals in their lives has changed. We've gone from this agriculture society where we thought of animals as tools or commodities to a point in time where we're using them mainly for aesthetic purposes. So basically the American public, for the most part, is viewing animals through the eyes of pet ownership. And as we all realize, you know, they care for their pets much differently than how we care for our animals in the livestock industry. And they're having a difficult time assimilating that thought process. So what Jameson argues is that the key to all this is that this old meta-narrative of anthropocentric instrumentalism no longer resonates with the American public. And so what's happened is we've got these activist groups, and we've also got philosophers rushing in trying to provide what this new meta-narrative is, or essentially what this new role of animals are in American lives, and it seems to be resonating with the American public. So the messages they're putting out are obviously, you can see that slide there on the bottom, to the pet owners in America, which represents a significant population in the U.S. And the message is, you love your animal, it's the center of your family. How can you have an animal at the center of your plate? And so boom, all of a sudden these animal welfare issues blow up. So to summarize on this first segment here is, consumers are increasingly viewing animals through basically the eyes of pet ownership. And we in the livestock industry are kind of still holding on to that old meta-narrative. Now, Jameson will argue that, you know, these opposing views are incompatible, and as long as we in the livestock industry continue to hold on to these meta-narratives tightly, these old meta-narratives, we're going to be unsustainable in the long run. So you may be sitting there going, well, does this mean that in the end we're just doomed to fail? I don't think that is the case, because there's one other important point that he makes in his presentation. And he claims, and if this is true, this is significant, that there is no dominant cohesive meta-narrative or role of animals in American lives that has been established yet, even though the activist groups and the philosophers are trying to establish that. So what this means for, let me back up here. I think I missed something very important. And I'm not condoning their activity whatsoever, but I always thought it was the activist groups that were kind of driving all this. And in a way, that's true. I mean, that still applies. But the American public had to be ripe for the picking to for this all to happen. I mean, if you think back 10 to 15 years ago, we've had animal rights groups, activist groups around for eons. And they've never gained traction with the American public. But this time around, they have. Okay, and that's once again because the American public is just set up for the messages that they've been pushing out. So, I'm out of order here, trying to rush things along, but the point I want to make is that if we in the livestock industry, and we're doing a good job of this, my encouragement for today is to continue to do it, is if we engage the consumer and continue to do so, we can help create what this new role of animals are in American lives. Now, the reason why I went through this big fancy explanation of saying, you know, the roles of, or people just change their viewpoints of animals at this day and time, is just to drive home the point that we're probably never going to go back the way it was unless something significant happens or drastic happens. But that doesn't still mean that we can't control our own destiny in the livestock industry. And once again, It includes things like being transparent with the public and re-engaging that consumer. So, consumer opinion. I don't have a lot of slides in this area, thank goodness, because of the time limitations, but just point out a few things. First thing I'll point out, this study and other studies just like it generally say that farm animal well-being is not really the first thing on the American public's mind. They've got a lot of other things going on, and it's just not something that they're really thinking about. But they will express an opinion when they're pushed, okay? And that opinion is important because that's what they take to the ballot box to vote on these initiatives. And it's also somewhat impacts their purchasing decisions at the store. So those opinions do matter. So the question is, what is the opinion of welfare in the beef cattle industry? This data came from a presentation given by Glenn Tonser at K-State, who's an economist at K-State, and this was presented just last month at the International Symposium on Beef Cattle Welfare that was hosted at K-State. And he's got data from 08 that basically shows the same thing, and when I saw this, that blew me away. From the standpoint that when we have an animal welfare issue arise, and if you've read that, you can already see that the public is saying that they're most concerned about beef cattle welfare. And why that's dumbfounding is because when these animal welfare issues arise, what's the species that is showing up center stage? It's dairy cattle, hogs, occasionally we'll see some chickens on there. And so why is this occurring? Well, Tonser's got two possible explanations. First one, he tries to put a positive spin on. He says, well, maybe what's happening is when we're asking the consumer this question, they're thinking, you know, beef cattle welfare is currently good. We don't want to see it deteriorate, so we're just going to say that's what we're concerned about. But he's also realistic in saying that probably really what is happening is that when we have these incidences like the dairy cow at Hallmark Westland in Chino, California, which resulted in our largest beef recall in U.S. history, that the American public is having a little difficult time kind of differentiating between dairy and beef. Okay, so they're deferring some of that concern. I really don't think it matters one way or the other what the answer is to that, if that is correct. What it does tell me is that we in the beef cattle industry kind of thought that we've been flying under the radar for some time now. It's not that we're not concerned, but at the same time, we haven't been winding up on the evening news like some of the other segments of the industry. But this tells us that we're evidently on the mind of the American consumer. Okay, and we have some vulnerabilities, I think you all agree, that we probably need to address, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. The other thing I want to point out about this study and just this reasoning that we're going through is that this also lets us know, Barry talked this morning about complex systems, how integrated we are in the livestock industry, meaning that what happened when that dairy cow in Chino, California hit the news? I know she was being ground up for beef. It just blasted beef prices, but it had absolutely no impact on milk and dairy prices, or milk and cheese prices, even though she was a dairy cow. Okay? So there's an impact, and this more Tonser information. I've got one more slide from him, and the reason why I'm using his stuff is because that's the most recent thing I was exposed to and easiest for me to get a hold of. But this is one other example here of some information that he got out of study that once again emphasizes this interrelatedness that we have in the industry. And what he has seen is that as these animal welfare issues arise, money leaves the meat complex and goes elsewhere. These consumers go elsewhere to get their protein sources. So what we're saying here is that we've got an incident that occurs in the hog industry. People quit buying pork. They don't go buy beef and chicken. They go elsewhere to get their protein source. So those dollars are no longer there for us to compete for in the meat complex. And so once again, we as the livestock industry, unfortunately, we've been doing a good job of this and not throwing each other under the bus for the most part. And we need to continue to work together as a unit because we have an impact on each other whether we think we do or not. Final one here. I think we got enough information about the consumer to know that they will vote to implement regulations to eliminate certain production systems or practices, whatever the case may be. But I don't think it has to be that way. Okay, and this is just related to, once again, a Tonser study, but this is something that he did in Michigan looking at consumer response to sow gestation stalls or banning sow gestation stalls. Interestingly enough, he showed that 20% of the population would only be satisfied if those gestation stalls were banned mandatorily. Okay, whereas the other 80% were just okay if the livestock industry or the hog industry in Michigan will go ahead and start phasing those out. Okay, and time frame, according to Tonser, really didn't matter. So what I'm saying here is that we've got some opportunities in our industry to take the bull by the horns, per se, and do what we currently need to do to change some things. And I think the public's going to be accepting of that, and that'll just avoid these types of regulations that they are trying to pass on us all the time. Okay, so I'll finish up here real quick. How are we doing on time? 5:25. I got 5 minutes. I can do it. All right, hold on. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things going on in the livestock industry. First thing I'll say is we have matured quite a bit over the last few years. I mean, when you go to meetings like this 2-3 years ago, what were we talking about? We were talking about HSUS and all the problems that they were creating for us, right? But now what we're hearing at these meetings is people are starting to talk about ways of being proactive and controlling our own destiny in this industry instead of letting the outsiders do so. So we've made some progress in this area, and we've seen commodity groups and few individuals especially getting reconnected with the consumer, and that is having a big impact. One thing I'll throw out here that has just been recently unveiled, kind of give you a look at where we're, one look at where we're going here in the future. This was once again unveiled at the livestock or the symposium at K-State, and that is the creation of the North American Food Animal Well-Being Commission beef. Okay, and there's supposed to be a pork and a poultry coming later on down the road. And essentially what this commission is going to do is start generating animal welfare studies here in America that fit with our type of production systems that we have here in the U.S. and North America. If you know anything about animal welfare studies, most of them that are being done that are kind of establishing standards and practices and systems are coming from the EU. And as you all realize, their livestock production systems are significantly different. So what this commission is doing by putting these studies together is to kind of help start establishing some of these standards and have some data to back it up. And God forbid, if regulations start being made by policymakers, these types of studies there will be available for those people to use when establishing those regulations. The people that are on this commission include animal welfare specialists such as Temple Grandin out of CSU, which you all pretty much know, also Janice Swanson from Michigan State. They've got livestock handling experts on there, which consists of people like Ron Gill from Texas A&M, Tom Knopfinger, who's a veterinarian from Binkelman, Nebraska, along with Temple Grandin. Veterinarians, a whole host of them, Dee Griffin from Nebraska, Dan Thompson from K-State, Dave Saklocha from Sublet, Kansas, Bob Smith from Oklahoma, animal scientists, and then they've also got a couple of representatives on that commission from Canada. Once again, rounding out it being a North American commission. People always wonder, you know, where are our vulnerabilities in the livestock industry, and they always kind of want a list. Well, this is kind of what this commission has determined are some of those vulnerabilities. Okay, in terms of environmental conditions, what they're talking here is about mitigating mud and heat stress conditions in feedlots and getting more data on this of how we need to approach these. Painful procedures such as castration, dehorning, branding. Do we need to be administering anesthetics and analgesics to control those painful procedures? I'll just skip on disposal of chronically ill animals and what the economics is behind that. Euthanasia techniques, and no pun intended, but when do we pull the trigger? You know, if you've got a down cow from calving paralysis, at what point do you say enough is enough and we euthanize that cow? And then dissociative feeder heifers. Okay, two more slides and I'm finished. I'm going to walk over here and get a drink of water real quick. This slide I'm going to use to kind of give you my opinion of where we're going in the future with animal welfare here in the U.S. We in the livestock industry have argued for eons, as long as an animal is healthy and productive, then we've taken care of all its welfare needs, right? Okay, that's a typical argument. But our animal welfare scientists around the world, people that are establishing regulations in EU countries and even our consumers are now saying that's not enough to assess what animal welfare is. And they're saying that we now need to be looking at the ability of an animal to express natural behaviors in the production system it is being housed in, and we also need to be taking care of that animal's affective states or addressing those issues also. I know this is a little harder. This is a little hard for everybody to accept. It was for me the first time around that I began seeing this stuff. But this is where they're pulling us towards. And I think that this is where we're going with all this, is when we evaluate production systems and when we evaluate production practices, we're going to have to look at all three, what I call the three-ring circus here, and that's my own coin phrase. We're going to have to look at all these factors, and we're going to have them somewhat balanced out to where we don't have too much emphasis on one or the other. And we already see those changes starting to occur. I just saw some recent information from the American Humane Certification Group, which is not associated with the HSUS, but they have just adopted modified egg-laying cages as to be humanely certified by their group. And that's a cage that they're using over the European Union countries now that differs significantly from the egg-laying cages that we're using here in the U.S. currently that have been outlawed in states like California. And that modified cage is kind of a compromise between all these three. Okay, it's not as bad as free range, and it's not as constrictive as the typical cages we're using, but this is kind of where we're headed. And I also was talking to somebody from the pork industry the other day that was saying they're already starting to look at freestall housing for their sows and then just putting them in these farrowing crates during strategic time. Okay, so this is the kind of direction that we're going. So I'll finish with this slide right here and give you some concluding thoughts. Change is imminent. I'm not saying we need to roll over and just let people run over us, but change is imminent. Okay? We can, on the other hand, I think, help create this new we can help create this new meta-narrative, okay, if we stay engaged with the American consumer. Keep an open mind. These concepts, the three-ring circus, I already told you, that was something that I've struggled with, still struggle with, because my opinion is as long as an animal is productive and it's healthy, we've addressed a lot of its welfare concerns. But those are the things that we're going to be asked to assimilate here in the future. Communicate, communicate, communicate with the American consumer. We're doing a good job. Everybody needs to get involved with that. Continually seek ways to improve animal well-being. And then last but not least, by all means, be proud of what you do. For God's sake, you're feeding the world, folks, and you should hold your head up high for that. Okay, so that's all I have, and I thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'll stay around as long as you want me to. On the other hand, like I said, there is beer and barbecue across town.